Hey there, it's Shamita here. The Pulitzer Prizes were announced this past week, honoring so many examples of excellence in journalism from the past year, many of which we have featured on our daily news podcast, Apple News Today, or on this show, In Conversation. Among the winners this year was The New Yorker for its investigative podcast, In the Dark, which told the story of possible U.S. military war crimes during the Iraq War. Last summer, I spoke with the host of In the Dark, Madeline Barron, about this investigation, so we wanted to resurface that episode for you this week. Congratulations to their team on winning a Pulitzer. I hope you enjoy listening. This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, how the shadowy military justice system buries possible war crimes. On November 19th of 2005, during the U.S. war in Iraq, a group of U.S. Marines killed 24 Iraqi men, women, and children in what would become known as the Haditha Massacre.
The Pentagon is investigating an alleged rampage by U.S. Marines in Iraq.
It all started when four Marine Humvees entered Haditha.
The Marines initially reported that more than a dozen civilians were killed in a roadside bombing and in the crossfire that followed.
But that was far from the truth.
It appears to have been an unprovoked attack by the Marines.
The people were killed when the Marines went into the houses and opened fire on them.
Killing women and children as they searched, unsuccessfully apparently, for insurgents.
Iraqi eyewitnesses claim the Marines simply went on a rampage.
Then President George W. Bush spoke about the killings.
I am troubled by the initial news stories. I am mindful that there is a thorough investigation going on. If, in fact, the laws were broken, there will be punishment.
But a punishment would never come.
The feeling about Haditha was, well, wasn't that the one that the American military vowed to get right? That this wasn't going to be one of those cases that you could say they didn't do anything?
That's Madeline Barron. She's host and lead reporter of the investigative podcast In the Dark from The New Yorker.
But when we started looking back into Haditha, it was, you know, surprising to remind ourselves that no one was punished for the killings.
Madeline and her team at The New Yorker took a deep dive into what exactly happened in Haditha and how it's possible there would never be accountability. They spoke with dozens of people, including survivors of the incident, sued the military to get tens of thousands of records, and obtained photos most never before seen by the public. They also put together the largest known collection of war crimes investigations by the U.S. military. It's really an incredible body of reporting, and their final episode of the podcast is out now. We started our conversation with Madeline explaining what the Marines were doing in the small Iraqi town in the first place.
So the Marines came to Haditha in 2005 to try to drive out insurgents that had been operating in Haditha and in that area. And, you know, we talked to a lot of Marines who were in the 3-1, the unit that came to Haditha, that the squad that carried out the killings was a part of. And, you know, they described thinking, like, from what they were being told initially, like, wow, this is going to be, like, really serious combat. Like, they were sort of terrified. They were sort of pumped. Like, there was a lot of adrenaline. And then they get into the town and, like, nothing's going on. And they describe the relentless boredom of being in Haditha.
Boring. So boring. It was talk to people, invite people in. It was talk to the sheik, talk to the neighborhood, talk to the women, talk to the... It was just all that hearts and minds kind of thing. There was no conflict.
We even have this pretty remarkable recording from a man who worked as an unusual job. A Marine combat artist was the actual job. He worked for the military, and he was there to record his observations. And so he recorded audio that he gave to us, which is very remarkable, of a meeting that one of the commanders had with his men, which included the squad leader who would carry out the killings or be involved in carrying out the killings later on, where he said, look.
Believe it or not, sooner or later, we will kill some of these folks who need to be killed.
You're going to get your chance. Like, I know you haven't gotten your chance to kill anybody. I know that must be frustrating to you.
And that's the beautiful thing about this world, is that there's always someone who needs to be killed.
Yeah.
And we're the folks to do it.
Yeah.
All right.
and you are going to get your chance to kill somebody, keep your spirits up. And I thought that audio recording, I mean, like, really showed us so clearly what the mentality was.
I want us to talk a little bit more about the incident itself and just establish some of the details that were known at the time, but then add on that with all that you've learned. So let's talk about what exactly happened in 2005.
So that morning, a squad of Marines set out on a routine mission to just basically drop off some supplies and come back to their little base in Haditha. And so they were in four Humvees. There they go. They're on their way back when the last Humvee in the convoy, an IED detonates right on it. And the Humvee explodes and a Marine, Lance Corporal Miguel Terrazas, is killed. Two other Marines are injured. The Marines say that they were taking some small arms fire initially after the IED exploded. What happens next over the next few hours is that there was a car carrying five men on their way to a college in Baghdad. That car had pulled over. The men had gotten out. The Marines shot all five of those men, mostly in the head. And then some of the Marines went into three houses and killed people in those houses. And the people that they killed in those houses included women, children. The oldest was a grandfather in his 70s. The youngest was a three-year-old girl. In one house, the Marines shot to death a mother on a bed surrounded by her children, who they also shot to death, shot the aunt who was next to the bed, shot another child who was on the other side of the bed. Mm. And so by the time the Marines were done killing, there were 24 dead civilians.
And what was the narrative that the Marines had of what happened there?
Well, I should say that, first of all, none of this was ever initially reported as an alleged war crime. So no one would have found out about this, and no one did find out about this for months. And so the initial story was there was no story. There was no need for a story. There was a story about how an IED had exploded and had killed some civilians, and then there was a crossfire, and that was a story. There was a press release that went out to that effect. But then when Time magazine broke this story in 2006, an investigation was launched that sort of begat multiple investigations after that. And in that first investigation, the Marines basically said, look, we were being attacked that day. And their story was that they were chasing insurgents that day, not intending to kill civilians. So that was the story. And then when there was a more involved, exhaustive investigation, a criminal investigation done by NCIS.
That's the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, right?
Yeah. They, NCIS, interrogated many of the same Marines for many, many hours. Some of them they interrogated more than once. And the stories, in some cases, started to change. And so one Marine, according to NCIS records, admitted that he knowingly was shooting women and children. He shot them anyway. You know, he described in one of the NCIS records a child on a bed and then just shooting the child. And that Marine, by the way, like, he later said, I didn't say those statements, basically implying that NCIS had manufactured his statement. But the story starts to change. Mm-hmm. And that NCIS investigation leads to criminal charges, murder charges filed against four of the Marines. And so that NCIS investigation, you know, we got a lot of those records. It was, it seems, very thorough. I mean, they went back into the houses. They scrape bullets out of the walls. They take photos of the dimensions of the room. They get out measuring tape. I mean, they do all of the things that you would expect to see in a criminal investigation. They hand it all to the prosecution. They did file murder charges against four Marines, but later dismissed those charges against three of the Marines. And then the fourth Marine did go to trial on lesser charges. But in the middle of that trial, it ended in a plea deal to a really minor charge, negligent dereliction of duty, which is, like, his own lawyer described it to me as, like, akin to a parking ticket. He didn't have any prison sentence at all. And then he left the military after that.
I want to back up a little bit and talk about the people who were affected in this. I understand that you went to Iraq. You and your team spoke with several Iraqi civilians who were there that day, some people whose family members were killed in this incident. One was a woman named Safa Yunus. She was 11 years old at the time of the massacre. She is now 30 years old. What did she tell your team?
Safa was in the bedroom where the Marines opened fire. Her mother and a lot of her siblings were on the bed, but Safa and one of her sister Noor, had decided to sort of drop down and hide behind the bed. And so they were, like, crouched down hiding when the Marines opened fire. And she said at one point the Marines appeared to fire under the bed and they missed her, but that's presumably when they hit her sister Noor. And so all the shooting ended. She realizes that Noor, who was next to her, her sister, is dead. She looks at the bed. She realizes that her mother is dead. Many of her siblings are dead. At that point, when her brother, Muhammad, who was 8, was still alive and he was bleeding, he looked like he'd maybe been shot in the hand. She tried to wrap his wounds with a towel or some kind of wrapping. She told him, like, shh, be quiet. You know, the Marines, they could come back. If you can just imagine this moment, I mean, it's an 11-year-old girl comforting her 8-year-old brother who's bleeding, who's been shot. Their dead mother is right next to them. And then, you know, and all of the dead siblings, a dead aunt on the floor. I mean, it's just absolutely horrific. And she then passes out. Safa passes out. When she wakes up, she sees everybody dead. At this point, her brother, Muhammad, has died. And she walks out of the house covered in blood. She goes to her relative's house, and she says, the Americans killed everyone.
What did others tell you about what they understood to have happened that day? And did anyone come to them with information about what was happening?
So, I mean, it was very clear to people in Haditha, Iraqis in Haditha, what had happened. You know, that they weren't going to believe the spin that this had happened because of an IED, you know, that they had been killed in an IED explosion. They knew what the truth was. One of Safa's relatives, a man that we spent a lot of time with, Khalid Salman Rasif, he's a lawyer, and 15 members of his family were killed that day. He's related to Safa and to family members in another house. And he really took this on as his mission to get an investigation launched to seek justice for the killing of his family members. And as part of that, you know, he was the one who, when he was eventually successful in pushing for an investigation, he did all kinds of things that ended up leading eventually to this Time magazine story and an investigation happening. He collected his family members. He collected Safa and Abdul Rahman, a 6-year-old boy in the house nearby, his sister Iman, other survivors, and brought them to give depositions and statements to American investigators and lawyers. And so they all did that. And, you know, I've read those. And as I say in the podcast, it's very difficult testimony that is being given. I mean, and extremely difficult, brutal questioning as well. But, you know, with the idea that this is necessary, like these children need to say what they saw so that the killers of their family members can be prosecuted. Fast forward to what happens in the cases when they actually approach trial. And in Wudurch's case, the squad leader, the one case that does go to trial, none of this information is used by the prosecution at trial. The jury doesn't hear it. So the jury doesn't hear the deposition of Safa or the deposition of Abdul Rahman or Iman. And so—
So they were essentially re-traumatized, but with no use for their stories in the end.
Yeah. And, you know, also the other thing that happened at this trial is that the names of the dead, instead of saying their names, which you would imagine would be common in a criminal case, you know, the prosecution starts out, this woman was a loving mother and this was a loving father and they had lives and they had family and now they're dead.
Yeah, to humanize,
you know, very typical.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
That's why they're there, because some people have been killed. In this trial, the victims' names were replaced by numbers. And so they were referred to as, you know, number 11 in this photo here, number 12 in that photo there, that kind of thing. And, you know, I should say that it's not necessarily just some cold, calculated idea, like let's just dehumanize them. It might be strategic. The Marines' lawyer, Wudurch's lawyer, Haytham Faraj, told me that his best guess as to why the prosecution wanted to do that was because the jury on this trial were all members of the military. And so the prosecutors are really in a unique and interesting situation of trying to figure out how to convince an all-military jury to hold one of their own accountable for killing. So that strategy, it's not surprising, might look very different than it would if that jury was just made up of like civilians or maybe a mix of civilians and military or something like that. You know, it's kind of like imagining if a police officer was on trial for police brutality, but the jury was made up entirely of fellow police officers. You know,
right,
how would you win that case? Maybe you could, and I'm not saying you couldn't, but your strategy would be very influenced by who was going to be deciding the outcome.
Of course. And I want to talk much more about Wudurch's trial in just a few minutes. I wanted to play a little bit of really impactful tape from the podcast. This is when your team spoke with two women who were married to two of the four brothers who were killed in the houses that the Marines went to that day. And they say that the Marines separated the men from the women and children and elderly, and they took the men into a separate house and shot four of them. I actually want to play tape of that interview with these women where they are speaking through an interpreter about the brothers that were killed.
قتل من بالأول منو شاف أخوه لأنهم كانت يعني محبتهم البعض مو طبيعية.
She's saying that she always thinks to herself that who was killed first, and if so, who saw the other being murdered in front of them, and she's like their relationship is so strong.
أقوم أتمنى بس يقول لي قتل منه بالأول يعني هاي أمنيتي ما أريد لا يتعاقب
إنه بس يقول لي قتل منه بالأول. She said that their relationship was so strong, they were really bonded, and she just wants to know who been murdered first, not for punishment or anything, just.
It's a really difficult to listen to piece of tape. Madeline, what was happening there?
Well, Najla and Ihab, I mean, we met with them over several days for many hours in Iraq. And, you know, this was a family that was so close. I mean, they had intentionally, like, lived in two houses right next to each other. There was a wall between the houses, and they tore it down so they could just, like, they just loved each other so much. They were, you know, like, a middle-class family. You know, they had plans, you know, children are going to go to college. And then all of that ends very suddenly in this horrific way where all four brothers are killed. So Najla's husband's killed. Ihab's husband is killed. Two other brothers are killed. And all of a sudden, half of the family basically is gone. Mm. And then, you know, Najla and Ihab describe how the brother's mother and father, the grandparents, were still alive at this point. But the grandfather, after this happened, he lost his sight. Like, he technically could see. They took him to an eye doctor. His eyes were fine. But the doctor was basically like, it's as though he doesn't want to see anything. Like, the world has nothing for him anymore. Mm. He has this, like, powerful reaction where he's essentially blind. The grandmother tried to kill herself. And, you know, it's just the devastation. And then also, on top of all of that, like what they're describing in the clip that you played, they just want to know, like, just tell us what you did. What they describe is that the Marines, as you said, separated them from the four brothers. They are being held in a house, one of the two houses. Two of the Marines take the four brothers. They see them being, like, marched into this house. The door is shut on them. They can't see what's going on in the other house. They hear gunshots. All of a sudden, the Marines run off. They rush into the house, of course, to see what had happened. And then that's when they find all four men dead, shot in the head. And Khalid Jamal, Najla's son, who was 14 when this happened, you know, he describes to me, like, wanting to talk to Frank Wooderich, one of the people involved in this. You know, he's gone to his Facebook page. He's thought about messaging him. He just wants Frank Wooderich to tell him what happened. And so just, so much complicated tragedy happening here, the killings, you know, what happens after the killings, the fact that nobody was punished for the killings, the fact that they don't know what happened, that, you know, nobody kept them informed of what was going on, according to the family members, as these cases proceeded, you know, down the path to prosecution or as they fell apart. You know, the kind of things that when you think about our justice system, which I'm not going to, you know, overly praise here, but there is a belief that the victims have some rights in that system. And I'm not saying that that always works well, but it seems to be mostly absent entirely in this case, to pretty devastating consequence to hear the family members describe it.
And I understand it was just earlier this year, through your requests, that these photographs that the military had of the scene were finally released to you, and now the New Yorker is publishing some of those. I just want to talk a little bit about what we see in the photographs. I mean, can you describe some of them? And I know that you spoke with some forensic investigators as well. What do they see when they look at these images?
So these are photos that were taken a few hours after the killings by Marines to basically document what had happened. So they show the bodies as they lay when they were shot. And there's photos of every single body. And what a lot of these photos show, and certainly what in the photos that we've published, what they show are people in defenseless positions. You know, dead women and children, people lying on a bed, people cowering, people huddled down. You know, in the podcast we describe it almost like the position you'd be in if you were doing like a tornado drill at school, like head pressed to the ground, huddled. You know, in one case in the living room of a house, there's a mother who has her arm around her four-year-old son, and they're both pressed down to the ground, like kind of like crouched down in a corner in their final moments. And you can see from one of those images of that mother and son that the son has been shot in the head. We sent these photos and all of the investigative material that was relevant to a forensic analyst that we worked with, a man named Kevin Parmalee. And he looked at this and he came to a conclusion, which was similar to the conclusion reached by military investigators, that in the case of the four-year-old boy who was killed, huddled with his mother, that the Marine who shot that boy had to be incredibly close to him, basically standing over the mother and child and firing down into the boy's head.
This is an up-close and personal shot where you're putting a bullet into a little boy.
Like he was shot from like one side of his head to the other.
He was executed from the back right to the front left temple while his face was down in a kneeling position.
And you're saying executed. Talk about that. Why are you saying executed?
There's no misconstruing the size of this child and the position that they're in, that they're not a threat to them.
And so the photos are graphic, yes, but they are also incredibly important pieces of evidence to show what really happened that day. And one of the main through lines of this story is just denying agency to the survivors, like discounting, downplaying, ignoring what is going on in the lives of the Iraqi civilians who survived this and whose family members were killed. So we didn't want to exacerbate that in any way. So the photos that we published on the New Yorker's website are photos that the family members who survived, the people depicted, their family members have consented to have those photos published. That was important to us as well, because those photos, you know, some of them are very graphic.
Yeah, they are. Let's talk a little bit about the aftermath and, as you've talked about, why no one was ever really held responsible for this. I understand four Marines were charged with murder. Those charges were ultimately dropped. The charges against one of the Marines were dismissed by General James Mattis, who went on to become Secretary of Defense. Can you talk a little bit about this case and why it unfolded the way it did?
Yeah, so this is the case of Lance Corporal Justin Sherritt. And this was one that was particularly interesting to us because, you know, Sherritt had told a story, a version of the story of how he had killed people in one of the houses that many people questioned. He basically said that, look, I went into this house with another Marine. I encountered a person pointing an AK-47 at me. I encountered another person pointing an AK-47 at me. And basically, I killed these people to save my own life. And the investigation basically found a lot of reasons to call Sherritt's account into question. And so there was a decision of, like, what should we do with this case? Should we take this case to trial or not against Sherritt for these killings? And, you know, we have all these documents that show a back and forth fight, basically a disagreement among lawyers who are advising the commander, who in this case, as you mentioned, was General Mattis, about what to do. So he's getting sort of conflicting advice. Mattis describes, he never talked to us for this reporting, but he did write about this in his memoir. He describes, you know, taking a lot of time to sit down and read everything. He described it as 9,000 pages of material that he personally read. And then he issues his decision, and his decision was to dismiss all charges against Sherritt. But it wasn't just to do that. He did something that was surprising even to Sherritt's own defense attorney, who a reporter on our team talked to. He wrote Sherritt a letter where he declared Sherritt innocent. He said, innocent in my eyes. And he also praised Sherritt for his time in the service. He basically said, look, you're doing what we want you to do. You're a brave person. You know, like, you are part of a fighting tradition, all of this kind of stuff. And the letter really, I mean, although technically it's addressed to Sherritt, it really seemed like it was addressed to all Marines or maybe even all service members serving in Iraq or Afghanistan at that time, because this gets at one of the issues with having a commander in a position of power like this. The commander's thinking about, sure, they're supposed to be thinking about the charges in this particular case, but they're also tasked with managing tens of thousands of troops, winning a war, whatever that might mean in this case. And so when Sherrick got that letter, I mean, his lawyer was like, I've never seen anything like this before. Mm. I mean, this man has like a multi-decade career and he'd never seen anything like that.
To have someone in Menace's position declare not only that he's not going forward with the proceedings, but oh, by the way, I believe you are absolutely innocent. That's really fairly remarkable.
Have you ever had another case in which an investigating officer or a judge or a convening authority, anyone, has in writing deemed your client, quote, innocent?
Never. Never.
And so that meant that there was going to be no punishment of Sherritt. And it also harmed, there was another Marine who was involved in that incident, but that letter made it all but impossible to carry forward the charges against him for his role in that same incident, which had been deemed essentially fine by General Mattis. And so then those charges were dropped too.
Are you referring to Wooderich?
Yes.
Frank Wooderich there? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, tell me about how those charges essentially ended, because that did go to trial, Wooderich's charges.
Right. So these cases, some of these cases kind of petered out early. Wooderich's case just drags on and on and on. And so he doesn't go to trial until 2012. So these killings happened in 2005. And so if you just imagine, you know, 2005, 2006, we're at the height of news coverage and attention and worldwide spotlight on the Iraq War. The Iraq War is happening then. 2012, Iraq War is over. People in the United States, at least, have largely moved on. Obama is president. We're kind of in this, like, looking forward moment, allegedly, in this country. And so although this trial is covered, it's not, like, given the prominent spotlight that perhaps it would have been if it had happened back at the time. Mm. So Wooderich went to trial for several of the killings and other related charges, you know, before an all-military jury at Camp Pendleton. And the trial ends before the jury gets a chance to deliberate, because both sides have reached a plea deal. And the plea deal is to drop all the charges except Wooderich would plead guilty to one count of negligent dereliction of duty, which is like an extremely low-level charge. It's a charge you could get for doing something like sleeping on while you're supposed to be on a watch, or like, you know, damaging a company vehicle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really low level. And so that's what he pled guilty to, and he received no prison sentence.
I thought it was fascinating how his own defense attorney said pretty plainly, like, this appears to be a war crime. This seems very evident.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Haytham Farrage is not shy about calling this a war crime.
These are babies. They didn't kill some nefarious, dangerous-looking, you know, men. These were babies. They're babies like my children, okay? And they were afraid that day, but they cower on the bed, terrified. And then some Marines walk in and start shooting them systematically.
His feeling was that Wooderich was facing a disproportionate amount of the blame for things that he blamed on other members of the squad. But in general, yes, his own defense was not that, like, everything that happened that day was fine, because how could you plausibly claim that to a jury? It was a little more nuanced than that. And so, yeah, Wooderich walked free and returned to civilian life, left the Marine Corps, and that was that.
One thing that you did say in the podcast at some point was, I mean, you just made the point that this is where American tax dollars go. They go toward our military. And it is a right of the people here to know what happens once our military is sent overseas, sent anywhere. Mm-hmm. What are the consequences of an American public that is and can be so disconnected from our wars and what happens on the ground?
Well, looking specifically about the questions about war crimes prosecutions, you know, you can't, you know, as a citizen, have a conversation, an informed conversation about whether this is a good system if you don't even know what the system is.
Yeah.
You know, so you can't possibly hold the military justice system accountable, whatever that might mean, if you literally are prevented from knowing what the military justice system is doing. So if a democracy relies on people having access to information, this is a great example of where that information, at least prior to our reporting, was sorely lacking. And that's, you know, I think that the lessons of Haditha are many, but one of them is just the importance of listening to the civilians in a conflict, not downplaying their story, and also asking really tough questions of the people who are in charge of both the people that are carrying out actions like that and then people in charge of prosecuting them. And in this particular case, that was the same group of people. It was both the military. So I think that, you know, the podcast really does both of these things. It looks very closely at the actual killings, what happened that day, who did what, what are the contradictions? What are the through lines? What can we determine happened that day? And then also, why was no one punished for this? What happened inside this opaque, bizarre military justice system once they got control of the cases? And I think both of those are equally important to understanding what happened in Haditha.
Madeline, thank you so much for your time and for this series.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You can listen to In the Dark on Apple Podcasts. There's so much we weren't able to get to in our conversation, so I highly recommend checking it out. We'll include a link on our show notes page.